From the NBC News Center in New York, this is NBC Nightly News, Thursday, August 8th, reported by John Chancellor.
Good evening. We now begin our special, continuous, all-evening coverage of the ordeal of President Nixon. He has said nothing in public today, but according to some of his own White House aides, some of the people who are on Vice President Ford's staff, and senior members of Congress, when Mr. Nixon appears on television this evening, he will announce that he intends to resign. He will appear at 9 o'clock this evening, Eastern Daylight Time, and some members of Congress are saying that his resignation will become effective tomorrow morning and that the new president will take his oath around midday tomorrow. The president had a long private talk this morning with Vice President Ford, and it's been widely reported that it was at this meeting that Ford learned of the president's plans. Here's the latest from the White House, reported by Tom Brokaw. To the White House on this busy and hectic day, Tom Brokaw, our correspondent there, has been covering the events of the day, which included a meeting this afternoon for 2 hours between Vice President Ford and Secretary of State Kissinger, which included, as we said earlier, a meeting this morning for 70 minutes between the Vice President, who was called into the President's office for a long talk. And when Mr. Ford emerged today, he looked somber and glum and did not answer the President's questions. We had further confirmation later this evening that the president is likely to resign, even though he hasn't said it, from a White House spokesman who said that Mr. Nixon and his family will fly to San Clemente, California sometime tomorrow, on Friday, and that instead of using what we used to call Air Force One, what the president called the Spirit of 76, that they will go on an Air Force plane, not of the presidential flight. And now we've made contact with Tom Brokaw at the White House, and here is his report.
Today, the television camera on the lawn that drew the crowd to the White House fence. The cameras were ordered removed, but the crowd stayed and grew as the news came out that the president and vice president were meeting. In the press room, it was wall-to-wall reporters and camera crews. Shortly after noon, word came that the president had asked for national television time tonight. Press Secretary Ron Ziegler
nearly broke up as he confirmed that.
I am aware of the intense interest of the American people and of you in this room concerning developments today and over the last few days. This has, of course, has been a difficult time. The President of the United States will meet various members of the bipartisan leadership of Congress here at the White House early this evening. Tonight at 9 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time, the President of the United States will address the nation on radio and television from his Oval Office.
Next door to the White House, a bank of phones have been installed to take the flood of calls, most of them in support of the president, but they changed nothing.
Late in the afternoon, four of the people closest to President Nixon during this troubled time were seen taking a walk across the White House lawn. They included his chief of staff, General Alexander Haig, and Secretary of State Kissinger, Rosemary Woods, his personal secretary, and James St. Clair, his chief defense lawyer. Presumably, St. Clair would be involved in any arrangements or negotiations to arrange for immunity from prosecution. Mr. Nixon spent most of the afternoon in his hideaway office, which is in the old executive office building next door to the White House. It is there that he likes to do his most private work and thinking. According to White House sources, the president's entire family will accompany him to California tomorrow morning. Mr. Nixon is not expected to be here for the swearing in of Gerald Ford as president. The entire Nixon family has been here all day, and they are expected to be in the Oval Office for the television speech tonight. That is Mrs. Nixon, daughters Tricia and Julie, and their husbands Edward Cox and David Eisenhower. President Nixon didn't ignore official business today. He nominated three federal judges, and he vetoed the agriculture appropriations bill, calling it inflationary. In about an hour, the bipartisan leadership of the Congress of the United States will begin a meeting with Mr. Nixon, probably his last as President of the United States. Tom Brokaw, NBC News at the White House.
The Associated Press reports that Vice President Ford told his senior staff people today that there would be a smooth and orderly transition to a new administration. Ron Nesson covered Ford on this eventful day.
Good morning.
How did you rest last night?
Vice President Ford left for his office before 8 o'clock on this most important day of his political life. Gerald Ford, whose greatest ambition had been to be Speaker of the House, was about to become president. He was smiling, almost jaunty. A friend described him as remarkably calm. Another friend said Mr. Ford was confident of his ability to run the country. His staff is working on an inauguration speech calling for national unity, drawing up a list of vice presidential possibilities and meeting on assignments for the White House. Mr. Ford canceled a political trip to the West because of the impending resignation, but he kept an appointment at Blair House. He rode over instead of walking to avoid the mob of reporters and cameramen which follows him everywhere now. At the Blair House ceremony, Mr. Ford presented medals of honor posthumously to the families of 7 Vietnam troopers. As he left, spectators applauded, a common occurrence. Ford is popular and should have no trouble leading the country out of the Watergate era. From here, Mr. Ford went to the White House for a 1-hour and 10-minute private farewell meeting with President Nixon. In the afternoon, Secretary of State Kissinger called on Mr. Ford. Kissinger is expected to remain as Secretary of State in a Ford administration. Mr. Ford does not have a strong background in foreign affairs, and he is likely to rely heavily on Kissinger's ability. Mr. Ford's office says he will watch President Nixon's speech tonight on television here at home. He is not home yet. Mr. Ford already is planning for what he told his staff would be a smooth and orderly transition. Most of the Nixon cabinet and senior advisors are expected to be asked to stay for a while, except Ron Ziegler, who Mr. Ford dislikes strongly. There is some grumbling by Ford associates that the Nixon staff is not being very helpful with the transition. Mr. Ford is expected to take a little time to pick a vice president. The names of Richardson, Rockefeller, Laird, and others are being considered, although Laird is a strong favorite to be the HEW secretary in the Ford administration. Ron Nesson, NBC News, from the Ford home in Alexandria, Virginia.
If the president does write a letter of resignation, the law says it must be delivered at the office of the Secretary of State. And as of the moment of its receipt, the vice president becomes president, even though he hasn't yet taken the oath. And members of Congress say that Henry Kissinger will get that letter tomorrow morning. In the meantime, the president has not, repeat not, made any statement of his own intentions. We'll have more on this story in a moment. At the U.S. Senate today, a resolution was introduced which would make the president immune from future criminal prosecution if he resigns. Some Democrats opposed it, and even the Republican who introduced it, Edward Brooke of Massachusetts, said he wouldn't vote for it unless the president makes a full confession of his Watergate involvement. Here's Catherine Mackin with more on that.
The sense of Congress idea seemed like a good idea to many senators at first, but then they all backed away, deciding to wait until they hear what the president says this evening. Specifically, they want to hear how he deals with his own guilt in Watergate. But other senators simply oppose the idea of congressional immunity.
A resolution of that kind poses a grave constitutional question based on the separation of powers between the executive and the legislative branches. And I think, basically, that this is a matter for the Department of Justice, the Attorney General, and Mr. Jaworski, the special prosecutor, to decide, as they have in previous cases.
In my judgment, it would be an intrusion upon the constitutional powers of the judiciary and the executive. Moreover, I think it would be a very bad precedent for Congress to initiate.
If the resignation contained defensive language with implications that it was that there was still innocence, then it might be the decision of the Congress, and it has to be first the House and then the Senate, that the trial should go forward to resolve the issue if there were still protesting that there was innocence.
I can envision the fact that he might want to resign in the best interest of the country and yet might consistently say that he was not guilty of any impeachable offenses. I do not think he would have to make an admission of guilt.
I would want full confession from the president of his involvement in Watergate and all related incidents. I think the American people are entitled to know all of the facts, and I think the president must make a clean breast of it. And when he does resign from office, I would agree that he certainly should not say that I'm resigning, but I'm not guilty of any offense.
Howard Baker and John Tower, both conservative Republicans, warned that there could be danger in treating the president too harshly. They said that resignation is punishment enough, and that with resignation, people should leave well enough alone. Catherine Mackin, NBC News at the Capitol.
Senator Sam Ervin is opposed to a congressional resolution on immunity. He said it would be unfortunate if Congress went on record saying the law should not be enforced just because a man has been a president. And as Ray Scherer reports from the House of Representatives, there are mixed feelings there about a House resolution on immunity from prosecution.
Members of the House of Representatives say their attitude toward the president after his resignation will be governed by the tone he sets in his speech tonight. Although some Democrats want the president to confess his guilt and promise to turn over everything to the special prosecutor, others say they will be satisfied if the president shows some degree of contrition and magnanimity. He cannot, they say, plead total innocence. House leaders, both Democratic and Republican, show no enthusiasm for the proposed sense of Congress resolution calling on Mr. Ford to pardon the ex-president. Speaker Albert said immunity is no business of Congress, and impeachment is over if the president steps down.
Well, if he resigns within before the proceedings start, I think the impeachment should not take place.
How do you feel about immunity for the president?
Well, I don't think the question of immunity is one that should officially come before the Congress. That's my personal view. I don't speak for any committee or even for the rest of the leadership. It seems to me that we have too many areas of governmental responsibility to consider before we start getting involved in something that we really have nothing to do with.
Albert went on to say the resignation should put an end to the Watergate affair since there was no suggestion that Mr. Ford had any hand in it. The speaker hopes the country will unite behind the new president. All told, there is an enormous sense of relief in Congress that an orderly transfer of power is underway. Ray Scherer, NBC News at the House of Representatives.
There are various sources in Washington this evening who believe that the timetable of the next day or two will be as follows. Tonight at 9 o'clock Eastern Time, the president will address the nation, and although he has said nothing, everyone familiar with his position is saying that he will announce plans to resign. Tomorrow morning, it's expected that the president's letter of resignation will be delivered to the office of the Secretary of State. It's expected that Mr. Ford will take the oath around midday in the East Room of the White House, and that President Nixon may, by then, be already on his way to California. It's predicted that Mr. Ford will make a nationally televised talk to the country tomorrow night for about a quarter of an hour, and that he will address a joint session of the Congress early next week. No one is absolutely certain of all of this, but that's the best information we have now. And we'll have more coverage of this story in a moment. The physical distance between Washington, D.C. and Whittier, California, the town in which Richard Nixon grew up, is about 3,000 miles. Emotionally, though, there was until very recently no distance at all. Richard Nixon cherished Whittier and said so often. Whittier cherished Richard Nixon and said all of his works and helped elect him twice. But now, it's not the same. Frank Burkholder was in Whittier today, and here is his story.
Richard Nixon grew up and became a man here in this suburb of Los Angeles, here at Whittier College. And his tragedy has a special meaning for the community of Whittier.
It's with a mixture of emotions that I'm here today because I grew up in this very area and rode the school bus and at the East Whittier School. where we would drop off the Nixon boys at their corner, right where we are today.
Dr. Paul Smith would teach constitutional history to Nixon the student a little differently next time.
I would emphasize the William Penn's holy experiment in government, wouldn't we all? Benjamin Franklin's tremendous emphasis upon humility, wouldn't we all, you see? Tremendous emphasis upon the Adams family, the most ethical family, I suppose, almost in American political history. We emphasized them then, but I'd do it all over again with even more emphasis. We all need it very, very badly. Not only Nixon, but you and I and all of us. That's what's needed, a renaissance in this country of a kind of a spiritual morality. That's what the lesson of this is.
There are other old friends here too distressed to say anything. Frank Burkholzer, NBC News, Whittier, California.
Gerald Ford's home is Grand Rapids, Michigan. He, too, has a deep affection and close relationship with his hometown. And Grand Rapids has always liked and admired Gerald Ford, people of all kinds and both major political parties, as we learn in this report from Jack Paxton.
Grand Rapids, an industrial city of 200,000, is the second largest in Michigan. Here people call Ford Jerry, whether they know him or not. It's not disrespect. It is genuine affection. It's hard to find even a Democrat here who has a bad word to say about him.
I think he's a very fine man. I think he's very honest.
He's all right in my books. Oh, I guess he's better than nothing, then.
I think he would make a good president.
I think it's the kind of a man the country needs right now.
I like him.
Even while vice president, Ford has stayed in close touch with Grand Rapids, his seat of power as a congressman, and from which he would draw some of his top aides as president. Those aides who now work for him in Washington are referred to there as the Michigan Mafia. The phrase implies efficiency more than anything else. Ford grew up in Grand Rapids. Here he was two. His high school graduation picture. In the Navy during World War II. Here, a year after marrying Elizabeth Bloomer, his wife of 25 years. They now have four children. Every year recently, Ford has made a special trip home to play a highly competitive game of golf, a sort of family championship, with his three brothers, two of whom we talked to.
Extremely competitive. Competitive in athletics, competitive in school, everything he did, he tried to excel at.
It was always the hero for me, and it's just a question of he's going further and further down the line. He's become more of a hero every day.
A few weeks ago, when Ford came home for a local festival, hundreds of people, many of them Democrats, patted him on the back and called him Jerry, as they always had. They talked about how Ford, as a congressman, had always helped the people in his district, whatever their party or color. They were certain he would always do that because, they said, he never changes. Jack Paxton, NBC News, Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Worldwide, the reaction to what May is happening today in Washington was uneasiness. The South Vietnamese worried about a renewed enemy offensive now that the President Nixon may be on the verge of resigning. In the Middle East, both Arabs and Israelis worried over the prospects of a final peace settlement. And the European NATO countries worried about arms and troop negotiations with the Soviet Union. The Russian people were told on television tonight, on Soviet television, that the president is about to resign. The president was in the Soviet Union only 6 weeks ago. And that brings us to an end of the nightly news, but our coverage of the president's story tonight is only beginning. He'll be on television at 9 o'clock Eastern Time, and until then, and for the rest of this evening, we'll be here on the air covering this story whichever way it leads us. And from every indication we have now, it will lead us in a tragic direction. We'll be back in a minute. Good evening. John Chancellor again for NBC News with our special coverage this evening, which will go on all evening, of the crisis of the presidency. Mr. Nixon at this hour is at the White House preparing for a talk he will give on television later this evening that we are told will last something under 30 minutes. The most fateful talk of one of the longest careers in the history of American politics. And now Tom Brokaw, our White House correspondent, has this report.
And then
Tom Brokaw has gone from our camera position there, which you saw just across from the White House, actually, in Lafayette Park, probably over to the White House to get some more information, and when he comes back, we'll put him back on. The crowds you saw have been at the White House all day, gathering in the early morning hours on a rainy day in Washington, a rainy August Thursday, and they've been there all day, and they'll probably be there most of the evening. The vice president said that he will be watching at home on television this evening. And to that end, we're going to go to Ron Nessen now, who's standing outside Mr. Ford's home. Ron?
John, the vice president hasn't arrived home yet from his office. He normally does come home about this time, between 7 and 7:30 Eastern time. One of the first things he normally does when he comes home is to take a swim in his backyard swimming pool. And there's no reason to believe that he won't follow that routine tonight. His office says that he will watch the president's speech here at home. It's a rather modest neighborhood where the vice president lives, in Alexandria, Virginia. He's lived in this house since the early 1950s. The vice president was supposed to move at the end of this month to an official vice presidential residence on Massachusetts Avenue in Washington, Embassy Row. It was supposed to be the large and rather elaborate home where the chiefs of naval operations have lived for some time. However, now the vice president will not be moving there, but if, as everyone believes, the president resigns tonight and Gerald Ford becomes president, he will be moving instead to the White House. Here at the Ford home in Alexandria are the vice president's wife, Mrs. Ford, his daughter, 17 years old, Susan, who is a student at a private school in a suburb of Washington. She will watch the president's speech with the family. The youngest son, Steve, who has just graduated from high school, is home and will watch the speech. Steve is not very happy about his father becoming president. He thinks it will interfere with his private life and turn a spotlight on his private life, and he said as much this afternoon when he drove home in his yellow Jeep from his summer job as a grass cutter for the National Park Service. Another Ford son, Jack Ford, who is a forestry student at Utah State University, is on his way now to Washington to share this moment with his father and with his family. The fourth Ford child is Michael. He was recently married. He's a seminary student just outside of Boston. And he was in Washington recently and is on his way to Boston. So perhaps he will be turned around and sent back here to share this with the family. As I said before, this neighborhood normally is quiet, but in the past few hours, if the cameraman could perhaps pan along here, you'll see that the telephone company has arrived and has been stringing wires for this camera and for other cameras and for telephones for reporters so they can file their reports on what's happening here in front of the Ford House. There's sort of a platoon of reporters and cameramen waiting out here. Mr. Ford's office said that he probably would not have anything to say after the president's speech tonight, but Mr. Ford is one of the most accessible politicians in recent years, perhaps the most accessible, plain-speaking politician since Harry Truman. And so these reporters and cameramen are here on the chance that Mr. Ford, as is his nature, will stop and talk tonight and tell what this moment means to him. John?
Sometime this week, you approached the vice president, and he didn't answer one single thing. And as he got in the car, he said, "Nice try, Ron." Do you think that he will, for example, bring the White House press conference back? Have you ever been able to discuss that? You've been with him for many months. No, I don't think Ron can hear me.
I'm sorry, I did not hear you, John. Could you repeat what you said?
Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now, Ron? No, I think while we get that communications fixed up with Ron Nessen, we can talk a little bit about a Ford administration. People are already beginning to make very serious suggestions to the vice president on his choice as vice president. Under the 25th Amendment to the Constitution, The president can choose a vice president if there is a vacancy in that office. And subject to a majority vote in the House and in the Senate, that man is his choice. Now, Gerald Ford has served about 8 months as vice president, having been chosen by Mr. Nixon and approved by the Congress to replace Spiro Agnew, who resigned in disgrace last December. So, Mr. Ford, should he become president, and the overwhelming indications are that he will become president, he will be the first president of the United States who was never popularly elected. He'll be the 38th president we've ever had, and the only one for which the people did not directly vote. And when he chooses a vice president, that vice president will be one of the, I think, the second vice president in the history of the United States for whom the people did not directly vote. So we'll have an interesting situation. And even tonight, before the president went on television, some people were sending notes to Gerald Ford suggesting the choice for vice president. The choices are interesting. The party is likely to have something of a split on this. The liberal and the conservative wings of the Republican Party may have some small difficulty in reconciling whatever choice Ford finally makes when he makes it. We'll be back with more coverage after this. Less than 2 hours now before Mr. Nixon makes his speech to the American people on radio and television. And standing by at the White House is our correspondent, Tom Brokaw.
John, we understand that President Nixon may have moved from his hideaway office in the Executive Office Building, which is just next door to the White House, and now is back in the West Wing, or the working wing of the White House, where he probably has his speech well in mind at this hour. He has scheduled a meeting with the bipartisan leadership of Congress for about 20 minutes from now at about 7:30 Eastern Daylight Time. It probably will be his last meeting with that group as the President of the United States. Tomorrow morning early, he is expected to leave for California with his entire family, which is here with him tonight. Mrs. Nixon, Tricia and Eddie Cox, and Julie and David Eisenhower. The President is not expected to be at the swearing-in of Gerald Ford as President. What the President will have to say tonight, we don't know. He likes to work on these speeches himself, but he will also have the assistance of Pat Buchanan, one of his principal speechwriters and political advisors, and Ray Price, who gives the president assistance, especially on momentous occasions. And this certainly is a momentous occasion for Richard Nixon, his last day probably as president of the United States. A bipartisan leadership meeting is expected, as I say, to begin in about 20 minutes. There was an unusual situation at the White House about 20 minutes ago. It was sealed off, in effect. Nothing panicky to read into that. The president apparently was about to walk across the street, and the White House guards decided not to have any reporters or other people going in and out of any of the gates. The press room was sealed off as well. All the reporters and cameramen were there, and they were not permitted to leave. Apparently, that was an attempt to keep President Nixon from being hounded, if you will, on this, the final evening, as he made a solitary walk.
Tom, John Chancellor here. Is this speech we're going to get tonight, do you think, and I know you probably can't say absolutely, the one the president told Price and Buchanan to begin drafting last Sunday up at Camp David?
I think that it probably has changed, as almost everything else has, John, over the past few days. He gave them some ideas. There was an interesting anecdote recently out about the president's recommendation to Spiro Agnew as he left office. He recommended the speech of King George, if you'll have to correct me on this. King Edward, I knew I was wrong, as he left the throne of England, calling that a speech of elegance and grace, and recommended the Spiro Agnew speechwriters take a look at that. Now, whether there will be any clue in that recommendation to Vice President Agnew in the speech that we hear tonight, I don't know. But I would guess that there have been any number of ideas, and the final product will be, as it almost always is in the case of Richard Nixon, largely his work, with some of the ideas and the grace of language coming from Ray Price and Pat Buchanan.
Tom, while I have you, I'd like to say that is it fair for us to believe that as of last Sunday, the president knew that something like this would take place?
as of last Sunday, he knew that it was something that he had to consider actively and seriously. It was one of the principal considerations and contingencies that Richard Nixon had to consider in this final week. He was getting a realistic appraisal of what Congress felt, even though he was not meeting with Republican congressmen or with Democrats, certainly. He was getting that appraisal, we're told, from the daily news summaries at the White House, which are accurate and in detail. And they were reflecting to him the erosion of support that he had within those two houses, especially after the publication of the June 23rd transcripts. So I think that Richard Nixon probably knew that this would be a week of very personal and painful and momentous decision-making for him.
Tom, I've read, and it has been reported today, that Henry Kissinger was with the family, the Nixon family, last night, and that he counseled that resignation would probably be the best course, and that General Alexander Haig counseled that resignation might be the best course. What's your view of these reports, which haven't been confirmed yet?
I think that these reports are largely realistic speculation, John. So far as I know, General Haig and Secretary Kissinger haven't been talking to very many people. We do know that Secretary Kissinger was there for 2 hours last night in the Executive Mansion talking with President Nixon, and that certainly the foreign policy would be a top priority consideration for the president. He did say that he would base his decision on the national interest. Secretary Kissinger was concerned about the posture of the United States during this very grave time, about the kind of unified front that we present internationally. And I'm sure that much of the conversation focused on that, whether it would be wise for President Nixon to continue to fight his case first in the House and then in the Senate and possibly weaken the united front of the United States internationally.
Tom, is it fair for us to believe another published report that the president arrived at his decision late last night or early this morning in the private quarters on the second floor of the White House?
It's very hard for me to say, John, but judging from the events of today, that is precisely where he made his decision, because that's where we know he was last night, and I have just been told by John Cochran, who has come over from the White House, that is where he is now, in the mansion, presumably with the family, which has been there all day today. Early this morning, Tricia and Eddie Cox took a early morning stroll, but there has been nothing else. John, you have something else you want to
say? No, I want to thank you, Tom, and I'd like to ask you to stand by, if you will, please. There are other aspects of this story that need to be discussed so that we can understand better what the president will tell us when he speaks on television tonight. And among them are some legal aspects of the situation he finds himself in now, having admitted what he did admit this week and the disclosures of the past concerning the Watergate and the cover-up. Articles of impeachment have been voted against the president. We must remind ourselves of that. There are three of those articles before the Congress. And this week we had some startling disclosures about the president's early role in the Watergate cover-up. Carl Stern of our legal staff and Richard Valeriani, who's covered Washington in many capacities for many years, are in our Washington studios now. And Carl, I'd like to put a question to you about the role in the past week or so of Mr. St. Clair, the president's lawyer. Is it fair to believe that St. Clair looked at these highly damaging tapes for the first time in the last week or so?
Well, we know that he had only heard two of the tapes up until quite recently. We do know that recently he began listening to a large number of them, along with Fred Bizart and three other members of the White House legal staff. So, in short, the answer to your question is yes. Only recently has he been listening to a great many of them, and that may have had a great deal to do with the president's decision, because it has been our assumption, Mr. St. Clair refused to discuss it, but he certainly didn't deny it, that he brought pressure to bear upon the president, indicating that some of these damaging tapes, particularly the ones of June 23rd, 1972, had to be made public or at least furnished to the prosecutor.
Carl, as a lawyer, can you give me the law on suppressing evidence of that kind if St. Clair, as an officer of the court and a member of the bar, had discovered this evidence last week, knew its materiality as far as the impeachment proceedings are concerned, would the law have said that he had to make it public or see that his client did?
Well, I don't think that the lawyer would necessarily be subject to prosecution for failing to impart information which he receives from his client when they're in an attorney-client relationship, but he certainly should encourage his client to make the truth known. Bear in mind that Mr. Nixon was not here in the position of a criminal, ordinary criminal defendant. In fact, one could argue, as many have, that he was not subject to criminal prosecution at all. And so the normal sorts of rules, I don't think, pertain. I think if, in fact, Mr. St. Clair insisted that the evidence be made public by the president, that was a course which was completely proper and justified by these facts. It was not an ordinary criminal prosecution.
Carl, I'd also like to ask you about the president's future, the possible, if he resigns, and if the Congress does not pass a resolution, which is not in itself binding, we understand that, what kind of problems might he have in the courts, both as a witness and as a possible defendant?
Well, John, as you know, the Congress was unable today to agree on any sort of a bill to give the president immunity from prosecution. In a strange sort of way, that may have done Mr. Nixon a favor. Once he leaves office, he's just as subject to subpoenas as anyone else. The Congress has left intact the only means that the president will have now, assuming he resigns, to keep from testifying, and that is the Fifth Amendment, the right against self-incrimination. However humiliating it might be to have to assert that right, it will be available to the president. The president will have no right to resist subpoenas, no right at all, except for that Fifth Amendment right, and it would have been lost had the Congress given him immunity from prosecution. Now, that's not to say he will be subpoenaed. Among the Watergate lawyers, only one, John J. Wilson, who is H.R. Haldeman's lawyer, has evinced an interest in subpoenaing the president. He may be reconsidering in light of the publication of the June 23rd transcripts, which hurt Mr. Haldeman, his client. It may be of interest to you, in searching the records, I find only one ex-president who's ever been called to testify. And that was by a Senate committee in 1912. It was Theodore Roosevelt, called before a committee looking into contributions by oil men and railroad men into the political campaign of 1904, and Roosevelt did testify. One interesting thing that will have to be watched, John, if the president resigns, is what happens to the White House tapes that were not turned over to the prosecutor. Last May 7th, the president's lawyer, James St. Clair, told a small group of reporters, including myself, that the tapes belonged to the United States, the physical tapes, the title to the tapes, and that those tapes would have to be left at the White House when the president left. Most lawyers would agree, since the tapes were made by government employees, they were made on government machines. I'm told, for example, that the tapes in the John F. Kennedy Library were deeded to the library by the government. No claim was made that they belonged to the estate of President Kennedy. In fact, if Gerald Ford does become president tomorrow, any future subpoenas for tapes would have to be directed to Gerald R. Ford, and that would be some way to begin.
I'd like to put a question about the law to Richard Valeriani. Dick, the letter that the president, that a president transmits if he resigns, has to be delivered to the Secretary of State. How did that come about?
John, the Secretary of State, in addition to his responsibilities in the area of foreign affairs, is also the registrar of documents for the U.S. government. He is, for example, the keeper of the Great Seal. And so it was determined that these letters, letters of resignation from a president or a vice president, should go to the Secretary of State. He is also the senior cabinet officer. And presumably, when the law was first written, that's why he was chosen.
As long as I have you, Dick, you're covering foreign affairs. We had a story on the news tonight that there was some apprehension overseas about the crisis we're passing through in the United States tonight and this week. Do you think that is justified uneasiness?
No, I don't, frankly, John. I think that astute diplomats in Washington have seen what was coming. They knew the critical situation here. Kissinger has talked frequently about the crisis of central authority. Kissinger has become very prestigious, and I think he has become a symbol of continuity of American policy. And after the meeting with Vice President Ford today, the Vice President's office put out a statement that said, in effect, The vice president has supported the policy as carried out by the Secretary of State during the past 5 years, and he believes that policy is in the best interests of the United States. That appeared to be a signal to other countries around the world that the policies will not change, there will be continuity.
I want to thank you both for being here and ask you to stand by. We've got quite an evening ahead of us, and I'll be calling on you later. We'll be back with more of this coverage after this. And here we are with more coverage of this momentous, tragic, sad evening, because it looks as though President Nixon is going to resign tonight. Millions and millions of Americans around the country are at their television sets or in their communities of many different kinds, talking to themselves and to other people about the crisis that we're in. We're going to have some reports on those plain people now, and the first one is brought to us by our correspondent, Betty Rollins, who's in Times Square in New York.
Going to the theater or to some other entertainment. For those people going into the theater, Mr. Nixon is still their president. It is likely when they come out, he will have announced his decision not to be their president. Meanwhile, people in New York are going about their business and pleasure as usual. There is surely a lot of interest here in the president's actions, but no one here on the street, at least, seems either upset or overjoyed by the impending change in their government. We've stopped a few people who seem to want to talk to us. What is your feeling about the president resigning?
I think it's the greatest thing that's happened to the country as far back as I can remember. It's a thrill to me. It gives me...
a possible chance for me.
And for the second time in my life, one day, the day after Pearl Harbor, and today, I feel very, very patriotic. Right after Pearl Harbor, I enlisted in the Army, and now I want to enlist back into the American way of life.
Thank you. What is your feeling about the president resigning?
Well, I think in spite of his resignation, the American people should be permitted to have all the facts concerning his involvement in the cover-up, regardless of his resignation.
Do you have any feelings about the man as this resignation is about to happen?
I have very great sadness concerning him as an individual, but I believe he should be a person who is responsible for his actions, and obviously he has to take the responsibility.
Thank you very much. You, sir?
My wife, I agree with exactly what she said. The only thing is, I do wish that he would be impeached. I would like to see the process go through.
Thank you. This is Betty Rollin in Times Square.
Here in Chicago, there appears to be a mood of anxious anticipation. People are scurrying home, someplace, any place they can find a television set, to see what everybody's calling the biggest political story in U.S. history. When you ask people how they feel about the prospect of Richard Nixon resigning tonight, most said they were glad. Some felt that he should be forced to go through the full impeachment process. Few said they felt very sorry for him, but very few said they thought he was getting a raw deal. In fact, just about everything that was talked about in Chicago concerned Richard Nixon and whether or not he would resign tonight. One man said he wouldn't believe it until he sees it. Although reactions are mixed, just about everybody agrees on one thing. They're glad that the whole Watergate mess may finally be coming to an end. This is Carol Simpson, NBC News, Chicago.
And just to summarize where we stand now, the Washington has been filled with reports from some very prestigious people today, some of whom gave their names and some of whom didn't, outlining not only the fact that they believe the president will announce his resignation tonight, but giving lots of details about his plans and intentions, and some of those traveling plans have been confirmed by the White House. That's what it looks like now. We'll be back with more coverage this evening after this. leaders of both parties in the House and in the Senate. Senator Eastland and Senator Mansfield are there. Senator Scott is there. From the House, Speaker Carl Albert for the Democrats and John Rhodes, the minority leader of the Republicans in the House of Representatives, are scheduled to be at the White House this moment with the president. The presumption is that the president is telling them what he's going to say to us, to you, and to the country at 9 o'clock tonight. I'd like to switch to Tom Brokaw, our White House correspondent at the White House, to see, Tom, anything new?
John, I understand that the meeting is going to be taking place in the Executive Office Building and that the president has now gone there. That is next door to the White House, of course. And he may not only be talking to them about his speech tonight, but it may be a very personal moment for the president as well, because at least three of these people the president has known well personally for a long time, Senator Scott, Senator Eastland, and Congressman Rhodes. He has also known, of course, Speaker Albert very well and Senator Mansfield, even though they are Democrats, as is Eastland from Mississippi, one of the president's favorite senators. We had the impression earlier that it might be a more broadly based bipartisan leadership meeting. Senator Griffin, the assistant Republican leader, a close friend of Vice President Gerald Ford, was expected to be here as well, and he may be yet. But this is the official word that we have from the White House at this time. There has been a White House explanation now and an apology for the sealing off of the White House earlier this evening. Mr. Nixon sent word that he would like to make that walk that I described for you from the EOB office that he has to the mansion privately without the press interfering or trailing him, and so he asked that an area be sealed off. Well, some of the guards overreacted, and so they sealed off the entire White House complex, and for about a half an hour, no one could get in or out of the press room. And there was some uncertainty, although certainly no panic on the part of anyone. And there has now been an apology from the White House. It has been an uncertain evening here, gathering crowds at the fence and around the television cameras as well. There's a certain sense of theater on this evening as well, a sense of theater that is grave at once and at the same time slightly frivolous on the part of some people. John?
Thank you, Tom. We'll be getting back to you later this evening. The future of what we may come to be calling a Ford administration, from what we know tonight, is an interesting one. The vice president has many friends in the Congress, some of whom went on to the Senate. One of those is former Senator Charles Goodell, who was the target of one of the strongest and most partisan attacks the White House has ever waged, or the Nixon White House ever waged, on a Republican. He was a Republican senator from New York. And Charles Goodell, it is widely reported, may be offered a senior post in a Ford administration. And Douglas Kuiker of our staff has former Senator Goodell in our Washington studios now.
Thank you, John. Senator Goodell, you're an old friend of Vice President Ford's. You know his political philosophy. I wonder if you could tell us, do you foresee any dramatic change in a Ford administration as far as policy is concerned in foreign affairs and domestic affairs than in the present, in contrast to the President Nixon administration?
No, I don't see any major change, particularly in the early days. Every man is his own man. Jerry Ford has a different style than President Nixon. But certainly he's made it clear he wants to keep Henry Kissinger, and he will go forward with the foreign policy initiatives that Mr. Nixon and Mr. Kissinger have started. And I think he will be very strong in terms of domestic policy. He's a moderate conservative. He will carry forward most of the Nixon administration policies. And somewhere down the road, he will start his own initiatives.
Have you had an opportunity to discuss this possibility of his taking over recently with Mr. Ford?
No, not. This has been, of course, a subject of discussion between the vice president and his various friends for some time as to what would happen if it did develop that the president went out of office. He certainly has been preparing for it, but has been very careful not to do anything in form or substance that would appear to contribute to Mr. Nixon going out of office. And I think he has been extremely loyal to the president.
You say he's been preparing for it. You mean he's been actively preparing for the possibility since the day he became vice president?
Well, he's recognized this possibility since he took over as vice president. You must remember he took over in the aftermath of the firing of Cox, and it's been quite a cycle of events since then. So Obviously, I think he has been aware that this could come to pass. He has hoped it would not come to pass, and I think very sincerely hoped it would not come to pass.
What about the cabinet, first of all? Do you foresee any quick changes in the cabinet, or do you think that he would ask all the present members to stay on? I'm not talking about it just for the time being, but let's say over the course of the next few months. For example, it was widely reported that he had disagreements with the defense secretary, Mr. Schlesinger.
Well, it's my understanding those disagreements were exaggerated. I think what the vice president said was that Mr. Schlesinger was one of the cabinet members he didn't know as well at the time, so he wasn't as strong in his feeling about retaining Mr. Schlesinger at that point. I think Jerry Ford has great confidence in Mr. Schlesinger at this stage, and my answer to your question would be I don't think he would remove anybody. I don't see heads rolling. There will be a gradual transition. It will be a natural transition, and I would say those who move out of the cabinet positions will do so with dignity and grace.
What about the other way around? It's customary for all members of a cabinet in a situation like this to give their resignations. Do you see any members of the Nixon cabinet who might want to leave now?
I don't think so. I think they will respond to Mr. Ford's appeal that they stay there and that he needs them at this point. And perhaps some of them have had in mind that they would like to leave shortly. There have been rumors that effect. And so maybe in the next few months there will be some changes, but I would expect that most of them would stay on. I think all of them stay on at least for the next few months.
One of the most important things Mr. Ford must do as quickly as possible, of course, is to choose a new vice president. A lot of names have been mentioned, including your own. Today, Senate Republican conservatives sent a list of 14 people whom they said would be satisfactory. Without going into names, what sort of vice president do you think that Mr. Ford will be apt to choose? A party giant like Nelson Rockefeller, or perhaps a younger, lesser known Republican figure such as yourself or Senator Brock from Tennessee or someone like that? Also, will he choose someone of his own conservative political persuasion, or is he apt to go left a bit and get a more moderate, liberal Republican?
I honestly don't know the answer to that question, Doug, and I don't think anybody does, including at this point, Jerry Ford. I don't think he is concentrated on this problem as yet. Clearly, he is going to listen to a great many people, Republicans and Democrats. He is going to consult, and I don't think he would make a hasty decision. I would not expect any announcement on this for some time. I mean, by some time, a matter of perhaps a week or two, or perhaps even more, not in over the weekend or in the days immediately ahead of us. I think he will want somebody that he's comfortable with, that he feels will complement him and work closely with him. Most importantly, I think he's going to choose somebody that he thinks is capable of taking over if something happens to him. Certainly, we've had it clearly demonstrated, the importance of who is selected for a job like this. Jerry Ford was nominated and approved by the Congress, and now he's becoming president. And whoever he chooses may be president. If not by natural succession, obviously he may be a candidate in the future.
Mr. Ford, of course, when he became vice president, announced publicly several times that he had no desire to run for the presidency in 1976. Now, of course, he's going to be the incumbent and probably the front runner as far as the Republican Party is concerned. I'm saying the nomination is his for re-election if he desires it. Do you think that he will desire it, or is there a possibility at all that he will step down in 76?
I think he sincerely right now believes that he would not seek the nomination. I think he's been very honest in his statements that he didn't desire it. I think it's going to be inevitable. I think he will be the candidate, and at that stage he will be willing and anxious to do it.
Thank you very much. Talking with former Senator Charles Goodell, who is telling us the sort of man Gerald Ford is and the type of administration that he is apt to mount. Now back to John Chancellor.
Goodell knew Mr. Ford when they served in the House together, and many of Mr. Ford's good and old and most trusted friends, such as Melvin Laird, are from those days when he had these friends in the House of Representatives. We're now going to see another friend of Mr. Ford's in the House of Representatives, one of the most interesting members of the Judiciary Committee and one of its most influential Republicans, and a man who found himself voting for impeachment. Robert McClory of Illinois, and Catherine Mackin is with him now.
Mr. McClory, when did you hear about the resignation? When did you actually get the word? Was it yesterday?
Well, I knew that the subject was being discussed yesterday, but I really didn't learn about it until today. And, of course, we've heard a great many rumors, but I guess we have pretty solid confirmation now that the president is going to resign and that the new president, the vice president, will be sworn in as president tomorrow noon, as I understand it.
Mr. McCrae, there's a lot of confusion about just what will happen to the president now, mostly concerning immunity from prosecution. Will you all in the House go ahead with your work, or what are you going to do over there?
Oh, no, we won't. This will be the end of the impeachment proceeding. We are concluding our report. We'll file our report with the House of Representatives, and we'll probably request the printing of many thousands of our copies of our report so they can be widely distributed around the country, but that will conclude our work.
Mm-hmm. Over here on the Senate side today, there was an awful lot of talk about waiting until they hear what the president says tonight, until they hear whether he admits his guilt in Watergate before deciding whether he should be immune from prosecution. How do you feel about that?
Well, I don't think really that Congress has anything to do with whether or not he has immunity or anything like that. I think it would be a mistake for us to take any kind of formal action, either by a joint resolution or by legislation. But I've talked to a number of the Democratic leaders, and of course the Republicans are certainly not interested in pursuing Mr. Nixon after his resignation. And I would say generally the attitude is that he will have been punished enough to have to resign from the highest office in the land. And this is really a very, very severe penalty.
Do you think the Democrats will go along with that? Have you heard anything?
Well, I've spoken with the, I've talked with the Speaker of the House and with the Chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. They both feel exactly the same way. They're not interested in pursuing the president beyond his resignation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Mr. McClory, for joining us.
Okay, Cassie.
Back to Joan.
That committee document that McClory was talking about will be published, according to other committee sources, in many thousands and thousands of copies and distributed around the country, and it will contain seriously damaging material about the president's involvement in Watergate. We'll be back with more coverage after this. Talking about the shape and the political coloration of a Ford administration has become legitimate this evening, because now even Robert McClory, who was one of the strongest Republicans, conservative Republicans in the House, we just saw a moment ago saying, yes, he's been told he believes that the president will resign. So it is fair to speculate. One of the things that the vice president did after he became vice president was to talk to various reporters about if something should happen, what people he would keep who are now in the administration and what people he would want to get rid of. And he did this in a very gentle way, and sometimes off the record with me on one occasion, and on the record on one occasion with John Osborne, a reporter for the New Republic who covers the White House. In April, it was reported in the New Republic that Henry Kissinger would stay on in a Ford administration, that George Shultz, who has departed as Secretary of the Treasury, would be brought back in some job, almost any job he wanted. He's highly regarded. That Peter Brennan, the Secretary of Labor, would stay on because Vice President Ford has a high regard of him. That Rogers Morton, the Secretary of the Interior, who has never, to use a John Ehrlichman word, tracked very well with the Nixon people, would be brought into the White House, and there's been speculation that he might be Chief of Staff. That James Lynn, a Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, has an excellent reputation according to Ford. That he hasn't seen enough, and this was in April, he may have seen more by now, Transportation Secretary Claude Briniger. As we heard former Senator Goodell say earlier, that the Vice President's regard for Defense Secretary Schlesinger may have gone up. Melvin Laird and Bryce Harlow, two old Republican warriors, would have strong voices in any Ford administration. So would Alexander Haig, who might be asked to stay on. The one thing that Osborne found when he talked with the vice president back then was there was one man who would probably have to go in a Ford administration, and that's the president's press secretary, Ronald Ziegler. And as we reported to you earlier, people are already making suggestions to the vice president that if when he becomes vice president or president, or if he does, that he should choose a conservative. Someone, the names that have been sent to him are William Brock of the Senate, James Buckley of the Senate, Dewey Bartlett, former Senator John Williams, Governor Ronald Reagan of California is on that list, which was sent to the vice president today by some conservative Republican senators. It did not mention the man most often mentioned for the job, the new job of vice president, and that's Nelson Rockefeller of New York. Nelson Rockefeller is said to be have a certain appeal, not only because of his money, not only because of his experience in politics, not only because of his admitted drive and intelligence and energy, but the fact is that in 1980, Nelson Rockefeller will be 72 years old, and that might make the political situation a little bit easier for the Republicans who might not want to have a dominant Rockefeller at that time. Another liberal possibility for vice president under a President Ford would be Elliot Richardson. You recall that he resigned as Attorney General, having served as Attorney General, Secretary of Defense, and Secretary of Health and Education and Welfare in the Nixon administration. The choice ought to be made in a very few days. It's something that needs to be done. There isn't anything in the law that says it has to be done quickly, but my personal guess is that we will know the answer to that question, and that question, liberal or conservative, vice president under Gerald Ford, will tell us something about the shape of Mr. Ford's politics himself and the look of his administration. On another subject, throughout these turbulent days, NBC News has been taking a poll to find out what people are thinking. The questions were asked during several days, both before and after President Nixon's announcement on Monday, in which he admitted having taken part in the Watergate cover-up. And Edwin Newman has the details on what that poll showed us. Ed?
Well, the NBC News poll, John, as you know, is a telephone poll of a scientifically selected sample of households across the nation. Before the president's statement on Monday, the one in which he released the transcripts, we polled 1,555 people. And since the president's statement, we have made a second poll of about 1,000 people. In that second poll, nearly half of those who were questioned took part in the first poll also, which gives us a good chance to see how things have changed since the transcripts were made available by the president. One of the questions we asked was, do you think the president should resign? Before the president's statement on Monday, 46% of those we polled said the president should resign, 47% said he should not, 7% were not sure. Since Monday, and during the events of the last 3 days, the results have changed. Now, 60% in the second said that he should resign, 34% said he should not, 6% were not sure. There was a significant increase in the number of those who said the president should step down. To come as close to the real